The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with a special report headline. Again, flooding from Hurricane Florence destroys lives and paralyzes economic activity in many towns east of the Triangle. This time, things may be worse than Hurricane Matthew in 2016. And that's the headline on the front page. The story begins with a second headline inside the Triangle Business Journal. A brutal storm, communities to feel impact of Florence for years. And this article is written by Lauren Onosorge and Dane Huffman. Restaurateur Dean Quadir saw photos of New Bern's Persimmons Waterfront Restaurant after he and his wife evacuated with their two young children before the storm hit. Executive chef Antonio Campolio had stayed behind, shooting FaceTime updates as the eight-year-old restaurant they had worked so hard to maintain was consumed by the Neuse River. A month ago, paddleboarders had glided past Persimmons' signature waterfront deck as tourists sipped cocktails overhead. But when Quadir returned to the restaurant September 17, it was barely recognizable. "It's a lot to take in," he says. "There are boats everywhere, there's debris, there are pieces of our restaurant all over the downtown area." The back deck, he says, is spread across New Bern. Hours away, Ernie Brame, too, is returning to his business, the Kenley 95 truck stop on I-95. On a typical day, the lot is lined with big rigs, but September 18, it's an empty swath of pavement. "There's no business," he says. Brame says he understands why Governor Roy Cooper and others told travelers to go around North Carolina, but he adds, "I understand we have to be safe. This just hurts." In Wilmington, a massive tree crushed the roof of the Indochine Thai restaurant. In Atlantic Beach, the town's only ocean fishing pier, the Oceanana, was damaged from the pummeling winds. In Duplin County, rising waters breached an earthen dam at a hog lagoon. In Brunswick County, waters cut off workers at a Duke Energy nuclear power plant. The stories, like the slow-moving Hurricane Florence that weakened once it hit land, seem to be endless. Beyond the frustration etched in the faces of many in eastern North Carolina was the realization that the costs of Florence could be staggering, a broad and brutal blow for a region of the state whose recovery from the Great Recession hasn't matched its urban counterparts. As of September 19, Hurricane Florence had killed 37 people, 27 in North Carolina. Roughly 10,000 homes have been destroyed or damaged. Hundreds of businesses are still without power. Hog lagoons are overflowing, creating a potential environmental disaster. And thousands of livestock are dead. "This is unlike anything I've ever seen before," says David Fountain, president of Duke Energy's North Carolina operation. Home damages widespread. In the days following the storm, it was impossible to assess the real estate damage. While the Triangle was largely spared. "No water on property, no damage," says Brian Aspill, corporate marketing director for one of Raleigh's most flood-prone spots, Crabtree Valley Mall. The same could not be said for much of the state, particularly east of I-95. Rain continued to fall in the days following the storm's trek, leaving open the possibility of additional floodwaters. Some parts of the state were still inaccessible September 18, and property owners in New Bern, Little Washington, and Wilmington were just starting to come to grips with personal stories of storm devastation, the kinds of narratives that can't be described through the statistics that will be coming. "We're doing our best," Quadir says. On September 19th, he had the first of what he expects will be many conversations with insurance adjusters about Persimmons. His executive chef, "Since there's nothing we can do for the restaurant," was cooking the remainder of Persimmons food for first responders. And Quadir was trying to wrap his head around what's next. "It's definitely not going to be cheap. There's still parts of the building we can't even access. We're looking at least six figures," he says. In addition to commercial losses, residential damage is likely to be devastating. Prior to the storm, CoreLogic estimated more than 210,000 homes across North Carolina's eastern counties were at risk, and that the cost of rebuilding those homes could reach nearly $43 billion. Initial estimates suggest there could be as many as 10,000 homes that are either damaged or destroyed, with about 4,500 in the New Bern area alone. A nightmare scenario. Just 6 months ago, Iowa 80 Group, which owns the Kenley 95 truck stop, announced plans to invest $4 million into the operation, expanding its diesel repair and customer service facilities, creating 15 new jobs. On September 18, however, Brame was bracing for a repeat of what happened 2 years ago, when Hurricane Matthew cut off I-95 trucking routes, forcing his customers to seek out alternative routes that cut out his truck stop completely. "It's hard to go through this," he says, "when we have the investment we do, when we need a certain level of business." The 10 days after Hurricane Matthew brought losses in excess of 50%, and he expects the same in this storm's aftermath. "We want people to be safe. It's just hard," he says. Floodwaters aren't the only hazard preventing vehicles from accessing eastern North Carolina. The North Carolina Department of Transportation has installed physical barricades, sometimes miles away from the actual flooding, to the chagrin of business owners. NCDOT Secretary Jim Trogdon says that while the barricades are preventing access to businesses like Brame's, they're also stationed at places picked because of their proximity to safe detours, those easily navigable by GPS devices. But I-40, as of September 18, was under 10 feet of water in some places, Trogdon says. "There's about 4 to 5 miles of it that looks like a river itself," he explains. As of September 19, nearly 800 roads across the state still had sections closed due to flooding. "The challenge is doing what you can, where you can, while we're waiting for this flood to subside," Trogdon says. "Then we'll assess the permanent damage and move on to the recovery phase, where we're actually doing long-term repairs." With waters not expected to crest until the end of the week, additional flooding is likely, he says. That's why the state has called in a vessel from Florida, one capable of holding between 500 and 1,000 tractor trailers. Trogdon says the plan was to dock the massive ship in Morehead City to ensure the coast has access to materials and equipment, in case floodwaters cut off access again. With such broad impact, Trogdon says the transportation hit is higher than in terms of recent memory. "I don't know what the total dollars will be," he says, "but as far as the vast areas that are inundated, I would say it's a combination of Hurricanes Floyd and Matthew together." Tourism dollars evaporate. September 15th was set to be a watershed day for Wilmington. Instead, heavy winds and rain show the dramatic economic impact a hurricane can have even as the summer fades. For the first time, the North Carolina Realtors Association planned to have its convention in the port city, and restaurants and hotels were ready to cash in on the September 15 through 18 event. A convention of that scope in September underscored how North Carolina coastal communities are luring visitors beyond the traditional summer season. "As a growing community, we've been extending our season and making it more of an all-around destination," says Nicholas Montoya, the general manager of the Blockade Runner Beach Resort and the chairman of the New Hanover County Tourism Development Authority. "The end for us is not Labor Day, it's Thanksgiving." Then Hurricane Florence blew in, bringing in national television broadcasts such as NBC News and Lester Holt into the city, but sending coastal residents, including Montoya, fleeing. Will Tuttle, the executive director of Visit North Carolina, says tourism is a $23 billion industry in North Carolina, and the coast plays a massive role. He says Visit NC numbers show the southeastern part of the state, essentially from Carteret County to the South Carolina line, punches an estimated economic impact of $6 million per day from visitors. Those dollars have major impacts on local budgets. Brunswick County reaped $34.6 million in local tax receipts from tourists in 2017, with New Hanover getting $23.5 million and Carteret County $21.5 million, according to NC Prosperity Zone numbers. "You're losing a good portion of that," Tuttle says. "Now it's not what it'd be over the summer, but still, a lot of us have worked on developing those shoulder seasons." Many coastal areas are still assessing the damage. Montoya, for example, was eager to return to town to inspect the blockade runner, but Tuttle says the long-term damage may have been more inland. "The impact varies. What we've seen in the past is coastal communities are very resilient. They rebuild pretty quickly," Tuttle says. "But the impact on some of the areas in the coastal plains further inland, where there's less infrastructure, less money, that impact can really be lasting. There are some places that aren't over the hurricane from 2 years ago. That's the small areas that have less resources. The impact on them tends to last longer." The other impact, he says, could be from the relentless coverage, especially the national attention, as Florence floundered across the eastern part of the state and national news outlets focused on North Carolina. The biggest concern is an image impact. We've had storms. If you look at the Outer Banks overall, they have been hit by a number of hurricanes and they've come back, and Wilmington will too, Tuttle says. But the buildup to this one seemed bigger than others, and the amount of media attention because it was so big at the beginning. That will leave a lasting impact. Sufferings of small businesses. The largest independent bookstore east of Raleigh was open for business September 18, but on this day, no one was flipping through the bestsellers or hanging out in general fiction. Kurt Finch, who has owned Emerald Isle Books and Toys for 30 years, says he expects to lose a full week's worth of business after Florence swamped the island. Normally, his 36,000-square-foot store will produce $3,000 in sales per day in the summer and still a healthy $1,000 per day in the fall season. But he closed for 5 days because of Florence, and even once he reopened, September 18, there was no traffic. But still, Finch knew he was one of the lucky ones in that the business wasn't damaged. Business owners and leaders across eastern North Carolina welcomed the sun back and wondered about the long-term implications of Florence. Trey Willis, whose parents opened Cap'n Willis Seafood Market in Emerald Isle 15 years ago, hoped to be open by September 22 after being closed a week. But his off-season traffic, normally about 20 people per day, might dwindle. Many of his sales in the fall come from selling bait. But the pier's gone, so I don't know how that will work out, he says. The experiences of Finch and Willis echo a report out of UNC Wilmington in 2002 that analyzed the impact of low-impact hurricanes. Those were hurricanes that were lesser Category 3 or below, such as Florence. The study noted that such hurricanes can cause less structural damage but still have a significant interruption on business. The hurricanes generally interrupt businesses for an average of 7 days, and sectors dependent on tourism can be impacted longer as tourists are slower to return. The report found that industries such as manufacturing, healthcare, and commercial construction recover more quickly. The report found a disproportionately high impact on taxes collected, as even a low-impact hurricane can slow the average annual growth rate from one-fifth to one-third. So if an area were growing 3% annually, a low-impact hurricane could knock that down to 2%. While many across North Carolina, the North Carolina coast, were still assessing damages, one who was clear on the impact of Florence was Emerald Isle Mayor Eddie Barber. Barber and two other town officials waited out the storm at Town Hall, and Barber was still sleeping on an air mattress there 5 days after the storm arrived. The community endured 72 hours of wind and rain, he says, and at least 85 homes have major damage. Barber says some of the damage is hard to see from the road, as Florence peeled off roof shingles and supports and sent torrents of water into the homes. Barber is well aware of what the small businesses are facing, as he and his family own the Ben & Jerry's ice cream store in town. "We do well. It's a good business," he says, "but you can't make any money when the doors are shut." And in an accompanying section called By the Numbers, effects of 8 trillion gallons of rain. 37, number of deaths associated with the storm as of September 20. 3.4 million, the number of chickens and turkeys killed due to drowning during Hurricane Florence. A total of 5,500 hogs also drowned. 105 miles per hour. Wilmington was hit by wind gusts of up to 105 miles per hour, the strongest wind in the city since 1958. 796, the number of sections of roads that were closed due to rising waters from Florence as of September 19. 2.1 million, number of customers without power at the storm's peak. As of September 20, only 121,000 were without power in North Carolina. 1 million, up to 1 million people evacuated their North Carolina homes, Governor Roy Cooper said on September 14. 20,000 plus. More than 20,000 people in 6 states, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, Maryland, and Tennessee, took shelter in 206 Red Cross and community shelters on September 13. 730,000 plus. The number of blankets available for evacuees, 6,000 cots, and 6 million meals have also been provided. 13. Number of nuclear reactors the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is monitoring near Florence's path. And 19. number of states sending teams to help North Carolina with Florence. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Raleigh looks to add massive tennis facility at Briar Creek. Raleigh's efforts to become a hub for tennis took a major step forward September 18 when City Council approved a lease for a 51-court facility in Briar Creek. We're off to the races, says Rob Autry, an entrepreneur who founded the Cafe Carolina chain, among other ventures. Autry's Triangle Racket Sports won a 50-year lease for 48 acres with the potential for extensions. The cost will start at $275,000 per year, sloping upward, and Autry expects a total investment of $25 million. The plan is a sprawling sports venture that will include a 2,500-seat center court, 32 clay courts, and 18 hard courts. The center will support the fast-growing sport of pickleball and squash, too. They were very careful on making certain that we checked a lot of boxes, Autry says of the city, and this was one of the first public-private engagements. This is new territory for them. This is a big piece of what they're trying to do for the future. Autry's goal is a vibrant facility that attracts both local players and major tennis tournaments. For example, the 50-court facility in Mobile, Alabama, often hosts Southern Regional Championships for the U.S. Tennis Association. Autry sees a day when Fed Cup, Davis Cup, and major USTA events come to Raleigh. The estimated annual economic impact for the city is $3.5 million. The facility, opening in 2020, would surpass the 32 courts at the Cary Tennis Center and 23 at Raleigh's Millbrook Exchange Tennis Center. Autry, 53, played in high school and college. He says the rise in interest in the sport and the relatively small number of public courts in the Raleigh area sparked his interest. Some courts will be available for free play in a family zone. Also, players can simply sign up for courts and pay a fee. And players can also join as members. The facility will have a health and wellness center, a pro shop, and other amenities. A part of my vision, Autry says, is it's not an exclusive. Raleigh Drone Company aids hurricane recovery. Raleigh drone developer Precision Hawk is deploying its aerial robots over flooded roadways, backing up NC Department of Transportation crews as they assess the damage from Hurricane Florence. Gladys Singh, vice president of enterprise services with Precision Hawk, says the drones began helping September 17. We've got three teams and are probably adding more two-person site teams. The original scope of the mission was 2 weeks, but might last longer. Historic Raleigh mansion on the market for $2.2 million. A Raleigh mansion with a fascinating connection to the city's political history is on the market. An 8,800-square-foot home at 2405 Glenwood Avenue that dates to 1928 is for sale for $2.199 million. Art Pope, CEO of Variety Wholesalers and a key leader of North Carolina's conservative movement, owned the home from 1987 to 1998. He sold it then to Jeanette and Wallace Hyde, who were major fundraisers for Democratic candidates. Jeanette Hyde led Bill Clinton's presidential campaign in North Carolina in 1992 and served as ambassador to Barbados. Wallace Hyde, who died in 2013, was a charter member of the North Carolina Board of Governors and once served as executive director of the state Democratic Party. It's a very famous house, says real estate agent Laura Bromhall, who has the listing. Since 2014, the home has been owned by Dr. Samuel St. Clair, a neurosurgeon, and his wife Marie. According to Wake County voting records, both are registered as unaffiliated. Raleigh Shopping Center sold. One of the key developers in Raleigh's history was Ed Richards, whose first project was Country Club Homes on Oberlin Road. Richards went on to develop North Hills, North Ridge, and multiple other projects across the region. One was Ridgewood Shopping Center in the early 1960s, and a tie to Richards' legacy ended this month when his grandchildren sold the complex. The family's company, along with brokerage team Berkeley Capital, sold the shopping center to Regency Centers for nearly $46 million. It was an emotional discussion among family members, certainly, says Andrew Teckett, Richard's grandson and owner of CCH Properties. The buyer of the 95,300-square-foot complex plans to introduce changes in the near future. We're looking at some placemaking opportunities to freshen up the look, says Matt Hagen, Regency Center's vice president at the Raleigh office. The Jacksonville, Florida-based company owns 13 shopping centers throughout the Triangle, including Cameron Village. Tekit says the decision to sell was based on divergent family interests and market timing. Helping out players with intellectual disabilities. A local association that uses tennis as a way to inspire people with intellectual disabilities has a big tournament planned and is looking for regular players to jump in and help. The Abilities Tennis Association of North Carolina holds clinics and tournaments around the state that are free for people with intellectual disabilities. The group is hosting its annual fundraiser October 19 at North Hills Club in Raleigh, with the proceeds helping to pay for 2019 events. The event had 110 people last year. This year, ATANC Executive Director Lou Welch says the goal is to have 175 people at the event and raise more than $25,000. The event begins at 5 p.m. and includes dinner, a live auction, and a band in the ballroom after tennis. You can see the Fighting Irish at Wake Forest for a price. Wake Forest University Athletics Director Ron Wellman is downplaying the Deacons' September 22 home game with University of Notre Dame, telling Triad Business Journal, "We approach all games in a similar fashion. The preparation is the same, but we'll have more people and we'll be prepared for that. It's not like homecoming. We'll treat it as a typical game." Perhaps, but not when it comes to the ticket price. Wake Forest varies the price of its tickets, and those for the November 17 home game with the University of Pittsburgh start at $20. But Notre Dame, tickets start at $95. Less than 1,000 remained earlier this week. The Irish played in Winston-Salem in 2011 and won 24-17 before a crowd of 36,307. Now we turn to the On Startups and Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. Carrie Mann, one of last plaintiffs accusing IBM of discrimination. A federal class action lawsuit out of New York accuses IBM of systemically laying off older employees in order to build a younger workforce. Henry Garretts, a 33-year IBM veteran and Cary resident, is one of three lead plaintiffs in the case. Garrett alleges that he was one of the oldest employees in his group when he lost his job as global commodity manager effective June 27, while he applied to several positions through IBM's own hiring platform, for which he was qualified. He didn't receive any responses, according to the suit. IBM has flagged the individuals who have been laid off as ineligible for consideration for other positions, the suit alleges. It has used this type of technique to prevent its older workers who have been laid off from obtaining new positions within the company. In the suit filed September 17, Garretts and fellow plaintiffs Edwin Roussis of California and Phil McGonigal of Georgia claimed they were among thousands of IBMers laid off as a result of a shift in IBM's personnel focus to the generation of workers referred to as millennials. That began in approximately 2012. IBM spokesman Doug Shelton said in an email that changes in our workforce are about skills, not age. Atlantic Coast Pipeline's stop work order is lifted. Natural gas line cuts through North Carolina. More than a month after being handed a stop work order from the federal government, the $6.5 billion Atlantic Coast Pipeline has a green light to resume construction on its planned natural gas pipeline. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission issued authorization for the project, a collaboration between Duke Energy and Dominion Energy, on September 17. NACP spokesman Aaron Ruby says crews would mobilize immediately. After an appeals court invalidated a pair of permits from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service, FERC, or F-E-R-C, had issued its order August 10, stopping the project in its tracks. In a letter lifting the order this month, Terry Turpin, director of the Office of Energy Projects, writes that the federal agencies issued revised statements working out the issues outlined by the appeals court. Construction activities along project areas which had previously received a notice to proceed may now continue, the letter stated. D.J. Gerken, a senior attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, which has been representing groups opposed to the pipeline, criticized the decision in a statement September 17. Rather than taking the time to address the major problems we have seen in federal agencies' reviews of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, These agencies continue to rush through a rubber stamp process that ignores legal requirements, not to mention the public interest, he stated. San Francisco startup plots more growth in Raleigh. 3 months into picking Raleigh for its East Coast hub, San Francisco-based container intelligence startup Sysdig, fueled by a new $68.5 million funder, is preparing to hire at an even faster clip than initially anticipated. A big part of the motivation to come to Raleigh, almost the entire motivation, was a desire to tap into a very rich talent pool, CEO Suresh Vasudevan says. Right now, the team has more than a dozen employees and is growing. When we started, we thought that in a year, we probably will get up to 30 employees, he says. At the pace that we're going, I don't think it will be more than a few months before we hit that mark. What's interesting is it's not just engineering, it's support, it's inside sales. The company sees Raleigh as a mirror site to its California headquarters, Vasudevan says. Durham startup responds in Shark Tank dispute. Durham startup Innerv Labs, spelled I-N-I-R-V, is firing back at Charlotte company Enventis, blaming the firm for Innerv's failure to secure an investment on ABC's Shark Tank earlier this year. Because the Enventis designed and manufactured prototype did not work, Innerv could not demonstrate the functionality of the Innerv React during ABC's Shark Tank demonstration, and Innerv was unable to receive investment. Its counterclaim filed September 13 alleges. Innerv Labs, which debuted on Shark Tank in January, says it signed a contract with Enventis to design and build a smart stove knob that would turn off the appliance automatically once it sensed danger from fire. Enventis had filed a lawsuit in June against Innerv, claiming that Innerv underpaid by more than $80,000, but Innerv claims it overpaid Enventis by tens of thousands of dollars, and that the prototypes Enventis did deliver failed to work as promised and did not fit the stove Innerv had prepared for its Shark Tank demonstration. But in a counterclaim, Innerv alleges that after more than 2 years and $215,000 in payments, Enventis failed to deliver to Innerv a working, manufacturer-ready prototype. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "It's more about having capital to make sure we can continue to invest and grow as we encounter new opportunities, whether that's an acquisition, maybe pulling some fun initiatives forward. This will give us the opportunity to learn in and be a little more aggressive, to lean in and be a little more aggressive." That's from Todd Olson, CEO of downtown Raleigh technology firm Pendo, after the firm disclosed a $50 million funder to fuel international growth. Now we turn to the On Real Estate section, written by Ben Graham. Developer of new 1,000-home community plots growth. If you thought building a 1,000-home community was being ambitious for this developer, think again. Developers behind the 1,000-home Collins Ridge community in Hillsboro are planning a commercial project on nearby land that could spur redevelopment south of downtown. While plans haven't been submitted to the town yet, investors with Daniel Boone Land Co. LLC say they are planning a major mixed-use development on the 59-acre Daniel Boone Village property, just north of I-85 along South Churton Street. "We're still in planning, but it will all be commercial," says Marion Utter, one of the investors in the group. "It will be retail and office and hopefully hotel." Exactly how the development takes place remains to be seen. Utter declined to provide further details. The group bought the land for $14.5 million and will bring in a partner to decide whether to develop or sell individual parcels, according to a press release from Trez Forman Capital Group. The firm provided a $16.64 million loan to help finance the land acquisition and commercial development. The property is currently home to a number of older retail buildings and fast food restaurants that will likely be torn down, Utter says. The former owner was Nahal Kalfas, according to business records, whose family developed and managed Daniel Boone Village. Utter's group, which includes investors who partner on master planned communities throughout the South, is now busy overseeing the installation of roads and water and sewer infrastructure on the residential portion of the development. Vertical construction on the new homes is expected to begin next year. Utter's team, which often operates under the name Criteria Development Company, took over the residential project in May after buying the entitled land for $7 million from Caruso Homes, the company that had ushered the mega project through the town approval process. The Collins Ridge project will have a significant impact on the town, adding more than 1,000 homes to a town with a population of just over 7,000. In its current form, the master plan allows for 950 dwelling units in addition to 88 affordable homes. New Durham apartment complex fetches $64 million. An Atlanta multifamily developer has cashed in on an investment next to Keystone Technology Park, selling an apartment complex for $64 million. Pollock Shores Real Estate Group built the 330-unit complex, now called the Republic Flats at 800 Finsbury Street, in 2016. According to county property records, the transaction breaks down to nearly $194,000 per unit. The development has 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units, according to its website. The buyer is Eaton Vance Corporation, a Massachusetts firm that has been active in the Triangle recently. In February, the firm closed on the $44 million purchase of a recently built Franklin at Crossroads apartments in Cary. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Restaurants and Retail, written by Dathan Kazuk. Chef makes the leap into Roman-style pizza. Growing up a Navy brat and watching the Food Network, Chef Teddy Diggs was always on the move and learning new recipes. Then, in the third grade, Diggs received an Emeril Lagasse cookbook for Christmas. And after high school, he attended the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. Diggs then worked in Washington, D.C., before landing a job at Martha's Vineyard, where he worked for 4 years. Finding it tough to live on the island financially, Diggs and his family moved to North Carolina, landing as the chef at Chapel Hill's El Palio at the Siena Hotel. Now he and his wife have a new adventure planned. What was it like coming from up north to your first job at El Palio? My family and I moved here from Massachusetts so that I could take the helm at the prestigious Siena Hotel and El Palio restaurant. It was a long interview process that worked out wonderfully for me. At the Siena Hotel, I had the immediate opportunity to get back to my Italian roots that were planted while I was freshly out of culinary school and in Washington. Regional Italian cooking was close to my heart, and Italian cuisine spoke to me for years. Il Palio would soon be going through a renovation, which I had significant input and control over. You have recently stepped down as the executive chef there to go in a new direction. What was behind that decision? I decided to step away as executive chef and food and beverage manager at the Siena Hotel. I was approaching my 5-year anniversary, and I had given an overwhelming amount of energy, focus, and passion into the building. I had yet to find the personal balance that is the proverbial white whale of the restaurant industry. I also wanted to start a family business, one where my wife and I could work together. We married nearly 10 years ago, and because of the strain that the restaurant industry often provides, we have not been able to spend time together. She's my partner in life, and now will be in business as well. She has an accounting background, and there is no one in the world who can tackle challenges like her. I am excited to have her on my team. Now, you are doing a new project called Coronado with Roman-style pizza. What sparked this? I love pizza. That is why I'm opening Coronado. The cracker-thin crusts of a Roman-style pizzeria are perfect for the American market right now. Pizza is and will always be a popular food choice, and Neapolitan-style doughs are having their moment. But back of this, the cracker-thin crusts of Rome will rise. I have frequently traveled to Italy for inspiration and career development, and I've been to Rome many times. On my first trip, I was taken aback by the personality of the city. And there's also a short note at the end of this article. After a deal fell through for a brick-and-mortar location, Diggs decided to do pop-up events, with one scheduled for September 23 at La Farm Bakery in Cary. Triangle Business Journal will follow his progress in coming issues. Food fans flock to event for hurricane relief. What happens when an event you have planned for the weekend gets canceled? Andrea Rusing of the Durham Hotel decided not to call it a day. Instead, she called a dozen of her local chef buddies to hold a fundraiser for victims of Hurricane Florence. So September 17, Rusing hosted the Florence Relief Dinner, a 4-course family-style dinner to help the NC Field Farm Worker Emergency Fund. For $60 per person, the dinner featured items such as chicken liver and foie gras mousseline, pasta, pomodoro, Surf City Grunt, braised lamb and country cassoulet with smoked pork belly. Some of the local chefs who came to Roysing's side included David Allworth of Gukulp, Matthew Kelly of Mateo, Phoebe Lawless of Scratch Baking, Bill Smith of Crook's Corner, and Sam Sukoff of The Pig. The event was originally capped at 100 guests, but as soon as the event was posted on social media, it sold out, so the hotel decided to open the event to 125 people. Other local businesses that helped were Ponysaurus Brewing and Steel String Brewing, which provided beer, Local Seafood, which provided 300 Roy Oysters, and Alley 26 and Epiphany Wine Company. Former Nana's owner launches new venture focused on chicken with a southern flair. Scott Howell, the longtime restaurateur in Durham, has teamed up with another well-known name to create a fast casual concept, Deluxe Chicken, spelled D-E-E-L-U-X-E, that will center on chicken but also includes seafood and sides with a southern flair. Howell was the owner of Nana's on University Avenue in Durham, which closed this summer. He owns Nana Steak, located next to the Durham Performing Arts Center, plus Nana Taco and Bar Virgil. Howell has now teamed up with Rick Robinson to launch Deluxe Chicken. Robinson started Mondo Bistro in Chapel Hill in 1993 before heading west to become the founding chef for Taylor's Refresher. That turned into Gott's Roadside with multiple locations in the western U.S. The new restaurant will open September 12 at 1116 Broad Street between Duke's East Campus and the North Carolina School of Science and Math. The casual atmosphere will allow patrons to order food and peruse the sauce station, which will be stocked with about a dozen signature creations. Scott and I met back in 1990 when we both worked at Magnolia Grill, Robinson says. We always knew we would collaborate on something special. It just took us 28 years to come up with Deluxe Chicken. The bar inside Deluxe Chicken will feature 8 North Carolina beer taps, as well as hand-selected bottles and cans, and a wine list. Durham Distiller honored for its gin. Durham Distillery was recently crowned the number one craft gin distillery in the U.S. by USA Today. This marks the third year in a row that this distillery has placed in the top three. Being honored as the number one craft gin distillery in the country is a fantastic achievement for us, said Melissa Katrinchik, president and CEO. Local restaurants give part of profits to relief. North Carolinians are always around to help their fellow man in times of trouble, and Hurricane Florence has left thousands in despair. One of the places willing to lend a helping hand is Sean Degnan, co-owner of Buku and Soka restaurants in Raleigh and Wake Forest. Degnan, upon seeing the damage caused by Florence, began donating 10% of all proceeds in the restaurants to the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. This will continue through September 23rd. The restaurants have already raised roughly $2,500 for the relief. Degnan and his partners are also behind a Place at the Table, a pay-what-you-can cafe located in downtown Raleigh. And now we turn to Viewpoint in the Triangle Business Journal to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Flood Insurance Fiasco Will Make Hurricane Losses Worse. By all accounts, it is clear that the Triangle dodged a bullet with Hurricane Florence. Yes, we had a lot of rain for 2 straight days, and yes, we've already heard about leaking roofs, damaged roads, and fallen trees. But it is nothing like what at least 6 counties to our east will be facing in the coming years. With the storm stalled over much of eastern North Carolina for a period of 4 days, the storm became a flooding event, not a wind event. And therein lies the long-standing impact. In the past few days, federal, state, and local agencies have been trying to assess the extent of damage to our infrastructure, personal properties, and commercial dwellings. That process will likely take weeks before recovery begins. Cities and towns such as Wilmington, New Bern, and Fayetteville were doused with an average of about 30 inches of rain, and with rivers running through these cities, the rise in the water levels on streets and causeways was dramatic. The levels have already started receding in these towns, and power is back on in most communities. Preliminary reports suggest at least 10,000 homes across eastern North Carolina have either been damaged or destroyed, and that number will multiply in the coming weeks. That also does not account for commercial structures. One may think insurance will cover most of it, but that's wrong. Economists such as Chuck Watson, who follows economic impact of natural disasters for Enki Research, estimated that about 70% of the affected homeowners may not have flood insurance. In North Carolina, only 35% of at-risk properties are covered, insured with flood coverage. What is even worse is that a big percentage of these homes were not in the flood zone, and therefore homeowners found no reason to buy flood insurance. While big storms are coming ashore on a regular basis, surprisingly, federal officials are seeing a decline in the number of flood insurance sold nationwide. A big part of the problem is education for prospective home buyers. If the house is not on a flood zone, real estate agents and people involved in the sale generally don't mention flood insurance to the prospective buyer. Chances are, if the agents mentioned flood insurance, the homeowners may think their biggest investment may soon be underwater. Flood insurance is a federal program run by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and it is running out of money. The heavily subsidized program funded by you and me was $25 billion in debt. The program is going through some changes, including raising premiums by as much as 25% for homeowners with second homes, businesses, and repetitive loss properties. Florence is about to aggravate that problem. And now we turn to Edward Marshall's column in the small business section. Edward Marshall is an adjunct professor in management at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University and author of Building Trust at the Speed of Change. The headline, Time to Stand Up for Truth Across Business Spectrum. Truth is not truth, we recently heard on the news, and I do not recall was recently heard in a congressional hearing. The assault on the truth is in full swing in Washington, D.C. and across the land. The truth is also under assault in business, where companies shade the truth to enhance the bottom line. We live in a culture where lying is rampant and there appears to be virtually no accountability. The era of the ends justify the means is in full swing. We're way past Enron, Volkswagen, or BP. Our system is infected with the cancer of lying. I never thought I would have to write a column about some of the most fundamental building blocks of integrity, trust, and dignity, but here we are. Put bluntly, lying is not okay. There are no legitimate justifications. It's more than unethical, it's immoral. And the consequences of unchecked dishonesty are severe. For leaders who lie or shade the truth, there is a fundamental loss of respect and trust by the workforce. There's no quick cure for the cancer of lying. Some thoughts on how we can begin to heal the cancer include, inside out, our integrity is inherently based on our values and how we express them in our behaviors toward others. An ethical inventory enables us to review our value priorities and where truth-telling fits. Moral compass. We each need to know where our true north is, that ethical red line that we will not cross where we will say no. A policy upholding truth. Leadership needs to establish a policy and set of guidelines about truthful behavior, zero tolerance for lying, and then walk the talk. Beyond a code of ethics? Companies need to go way beyond the code of ethics that hangs on the wall in the reception area. The truth and ethics need to be discussed at company or departmental meetings, in teams, and are used to make decisions. A practice of accountability. People who cross the line or lie must be held accountable, no matter what title or position they hold. This is the fiduciary responsibility of the board and senior leadership. If we are to begin to heal from the cancer of lying, not only in our national culture, but in our leadership cultures at work, each one of us has an obligation to be clear that lying is not okay, ever. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we have some news from around the state. Family Dollar's Matthews headquarters to close, 900 North Carolina jobs impacted. This article is written by Jennifer Thomas. Family Dollar's parent company will shutter its Matthews headquarters where roughly 900 employees work in fall 2019. The company is eliminating 200 positions and has offered about 700 employees an opportunity to relocate to a new consolidated facility under construction in Chesapeake, Virginia. There are no positions that are going away today or this year, says Randy Geiler, Vice President of Investor Relations, we want to give as much intel as possible to our associates. Dollar Tree acquired the Family Store retail chain in 2015. The Matthews Distribution Center will remain open. Dollar Tree's 12-story, 510,000-square-foot Virginia headquarters facility is slated for completion next fall. Consolidating operations will improve efficiency and create enhanced collaboration, communication, and teamwork, says Gary Philbin, Dollar Tree's chief executive. Leadership from both banners has continued to work together to integrate our two organizations and invest in future growth, he says. Dollar Tree operated 15,073 stores across 48 states and 5 Canadian provinces as of August 4. That includes 8,261 Family Dollar stores. Dollar Tree expects to incur total pre-tax expenses of $40 million to $49 million, including up to $8 million in fiscal 2018, related to those consolidation plans. Expenses will include job transition and relocation costs, outplacement services, and one-time severance-related benefits. Charlotte Chamber, regional partnership to merge and develop a unified strategy. The Charlotte Chamber of Commerce and the Charlotte Regional Partnership are finalizing a merger of the two economic development organizations that would be led by a CEO to be hired after a national search, Charlotte Business Journal has learned. Past, current, and future leaders of the two organizations' boards have devoted months seeking solutions to recruit more effectively after years of dysfunction between the two groups and a lack of cohesion in the overall economic development strategy. The board of the partnership and the chamber's executive committee voted unanimously recently to authorize their CEOs and staff to engage in the steps necessary to formally combine the organizations, according to a statement. If approved, the new enterprise will begin operations on January 1, 2019, the statement said. Both organizations are nonprofits. The partnership focuses on recruiting companies and industry in a 16-county region that includes 4 counties in South Carolina. And now we turn to the executive voice that focuses on Aaron Nelson. Aaron Nelson is the president and CEO, title Chapel Hill Carrboro Chamber of Commerce, age 43, education BA philosophy, UNC Chapel Hill, family wife Sonia, children Max and Atlee, first job short order cook at Philly Steak and Subs next to Wake Med. And this Q&A column is written by Dane Huffman. The headline, he leads an evolution in Chapel Hill. Aaron Nelson majored in philosophy as a student at UNC Chapel Hill and has since transitioned to the leader of the Chapel Hill Carrboro Chamber of Commerce. It's his role to listen to the 900 members of the chamber, to connect that with the wishes of the broader community, and to help Chapel Hill and Carrboro retain their small-town charm, all while embracing the dramatic changes happening across the triangle. How different is the market now from when you became CEO in 2001? The local economy is far more dynamic. Chapel Hill and Carrboro have been evolving from a university-only community to one with diverse and vibrant downtowns, a growing healthcare and technology center, and one that not only births great companies but also finds a way to keep them and helps them grow. What challenges do those changes present for the chamber? Back in 2001, one of the biggest challenges for our local merchants was having enough parking nearby, as well as competing with the new streets at South Point, 2002, and other retail being built just outside of the city limits. While those challenges remain, now small business owners are also up against online shopping with the convenient one-click, next-day free delivery. New technologies mean new realities for local businesses, and to me that means it's more important than ever to develop downtowns with residential density and cultural and entertainment destinations to drive shoppers and visitors downtown. How has Chapel Hill evolved when it comes to local business? Over the last 20 years, we have enjoyed a 180-degree evolution in Chapel Hill and Carrboro's support for local business and economic development. We deserved a well-earned reputation that it was hard to do business here, but that has entirely changed. Chapel Hill's economic development strategy, commitment to being open to business, and its director, Dwight Bassett, has put Chapel Hill back on the map with like cities from across the nation as a great place to grow and start a business. Carrboro has a goal of doubling the commercial tax base, and Orange County, under the seasoned economic development leadership of Director Steve Brantley, is actively competing for economic investment and winning. Today, Chapel Hill has the most pro-business mayor in Pam Hemminger and pro-business town council. Like a restaurant where you may have had a bad meal a long time ago, Greater Chapel Hill wants you to give us another try. We have new ownership, a new chef, and a new menu. How does Chapel Hill retain its sense of identity? Chapel Hill is like most college towns. Residents think it was the perfect the day they moved here, and students think it was perfect the day they left. The reality is that we have always been growing and changing, and we have successfully found a way to do it while retaining our culture, identity, and our soul. University Square and Granville Towers replaced the high school on Franklin Street in the 1960s. University Mall was born in the 1980s, and Southern Village in the 1990s. Yet, after each of these major changes, Chapel Hill remained its charming, progressive, rambunctious self. Tell us about growth in your market. Over the last decade, Chapel Hill's annual population growth is less than 1%, and Orange County is on track for the 2010s to be one of the slowest growing decades since the 1960s. It is our surrounding counties, Durham, Chatham, that are growing rapidly, while our growth has remained relatively flat. As they grow, these neighboring counties are also improving their public educational system, public educational achievement, and seeing increasing median home sale prices, two things Chapel Hill has traditionally hung its hat on as best in class. Locally, we are talking a lot about what it means and what it takes to maintain our competitive advantage. What are the primary concerns you hear from members? The key challenges we are hearing now include talent retention and attraction, customer acquisition, cost of operation, healthcare, rent, tech, and marketing messaging with declining local media and an increasing din of social media. We're committed to addressing them all and doing everything in our power to help our members thrive. What about affordable housing? Having an affordable housing stock proximate to employment centers is critical to retaining and attracting workers and reducing the need for transportation infrastructure investments. Traditional affordable housing solutions, mostly focused on ownership, while innovative when created and successful by many measures, have delivered only a few dozen local units per year, and each new unit requires as much as $120,000 in public and private subsidy. It's time for new tools and partnerships that can harness the power of our existing supply of market-rate rental housing and the thousands of new market-rate units in the pipeline. We are working with partners to promote a concept called master leasing that can quickly get people into affordable and safe housing at a much lower price. Is there something special in your office? 10 years ago, Sonia, Max, and Adley tested out the new office color copy machine and made a copy of their hands. It's framed in my office. Any advice for people starting their own business? Plan well. Seek advice. Ask lots of questions. Think before jumping in. And once you jump in, swim like hell. But don't be too busy to take a moment to look up and look for partners and to ask for help. Never be too busy swimming to talk about stroke technique. And if you like blue skies, good food, school spirit, and a small town feel with big city amenities that is near an international airport and conveniently situated next to a research university and the world-renowned Research Triangle Park, then come do it in Chapel Hill. And in our final minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read as much as we can of a related article to the special report. The headline on this one: Florence set to become one of the costliest storms ever, written by Sugata Mukherjee. In 2016, when Hurricane Matthew was churning near Haiti, businesses across the Carolinas coast started feeling queasy. By October 6, it was apparent that Matthew was going to brush along the Florida coastline with the eye of the storm making landfall in the South Carolina-Georgia border. The National Hurricane Center concluded that Matthew made four landfalls in its trek from Venezuela and Colombia. It remained a Category 1 hurricane across South Carolina before reaching North Carolina and moving away from shore a couple of days later. Matthew hit the eastern coast of Haiti on October 4, and by October 9, it was back in the middle of the Atlantic as a low-pressure system, in all, about a six-day phenomenon. Hurricane Florence was nothing like that. While the initial stages of understanding the extent of the damage is underway, almost all economists agree that Florence would pack a much bigger punch than Matthew when it comes to economic losses. In 2017 to 2018 dollars, collective damages from Matthew totaled about $15.4 billion, making it the 15th costliest natural disaster in America. Chuck Watson of Enki Research says that if Florence had been a typical hurricane, it would have been a $12 billion event. But the stall and the extra rain from Florence is the biggest problem that will add another $13 billion to the losses. Watson estimates Florence will break the top 10 cost of natural disasters in the U.S. I think Hurricane Floyd may be more comparable to Florence this time, Watson estimates. Floyd, adjusted for inflation today, would be about a $20 billion event. Florence would be about a $25 billion economic impact. Moody's Analytics estimates that property damage estimates will rush past $17 billion, and if further flooding occurs in the coming weeks, the number could rise. In a broader sense, hurricanes often have a minimal long-term impact on the U.S. economy. If one takes the Florence economic loss to be about $20 billion based on U.S. $19 trillion gross domestic product GDP estimate, the loss in economic output from Florence is expected to be about a 0.2 percentage point hit to the GDP for the third quarter, according to Moody's Analytics. Economic output measures the value of all sales of goods and services. Almost every economist following the economic aftermath caused by this brutal water-filled storm agree that Florence will be among the 10 costliest storms in U.S. history, and that's partly because of increased construction costs in coastal areas. And from AccuWeather, a Pennsylvania-based media organization that analyzes, among other things, the economic impact of weather-related disasters, AccuWeather estimates that Florence will cause $30 to $60 billion in economic impact and damage. And we'll have to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.